Thank you. I'm Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi. I want to thank the committee for including me in this beautiful weekend. And I want to thank you for coming. If you weren't here this morning and this afternoon, you done missed the program. When I first met Frank, he had a little more hair than he has now, and it was a little different color. When I first met Clancy, he had a little bit more hair, but fewer teeth. And I was much prettier than him now. I had black hair. Of course, I could have it again. But the upkeep is too high. Because of people like you, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a loving God whom I found after finding you, I haven't had to have a drink or sedating or tranquilizing pill for something over 35 years. I should have been up before Frank because he's got 36 years, I think. And I would rather have been the eldest statesman. I don't know what for, but I've had lots of good AA in your area, all over this country up here, for a long time. It's been my happy privilege to spend a great deal of time, well, as a matter of fact, not only here, but pretty nearly every place else. Because I quit trying to go any place 35 years ago. And since I quit trying to go any place, I've been all over the world. And so, I met a lot of people. But I don't suppose that I've ever heard any better AA than we've had right here since this thing started. I thought this afternoon Clancy had really outdone himself. It's the only competition he has. Tell you a little story. A number of years ago, well, it was when Sandy Koufax was pitching for the Dodgers, quite a while back, and Clancy and a gal by the name of Luann came clear across town to my plant, which was down on Alameda Street in Los Angeles, and brought me a pair of tickets to the World Series game where Sandy Koufax was pitching. And Clancy presented me with these two tickets, and then he asked me if I'd be his sponsor. Well, I'd be damned if I was going to give him back the two tickets. So I told him that He could call me sponsor if he wanted to. But I wouldn't think of him as my baby. Because I don't have babies in this society. And I don't consider myself a sponsor to anybody. And I've never had a sponsor. I certainly don't want to get involved in thinking that I've had anything to do with your sobriety when I couldn't get sober myself. So I don't want to take any credit for anybody else's sobriety. And when I got to the program, I had no idea what a sponsor was. And so I wasn't much concerned about that. And when I found out what a sponsor was, I didn't think I was entitled to that much consideration, that I should ask somebody to be my sponsor. So I never asked anybody. And when I might have asked somebody to be my sponsor, I already had 1,000 and a God of my very own. So it was too late. And now, whether you like it or not, every one of you are my sponsor. Every one of you. As a matter of fact, the entire human race is my sponsor. Some of them teaching me what to do. And some of them teaching me what not to do. And I figure that the ones that teach me what not to do are just as valuable as the ones that teach me what to do. And so I haven't felt the need of a single sponsor. I like to have you all. When I needed you, you were in no place. You know? I was out of good drinking time before Alcoholics Anonymous was born. Our program is 45 years old. The 10th day of last June. Bless you. She's trying to get in the act. She's sneezing. Hi. And before Alcoholics Anonymous was born, I had become a periodic drunk because I wasn't going to be beaten by this bottle. And you can't fight a very good battle when you're down on your back. So I became a periodic 11 years before coming to the program. And I was dry as I am tonight between every two drunks for 11 years. But I always got drunk again. Several things that I can't convince myself that are true yet, but they are. First place, best I can figure, I drank for 28 years. And up until the last drunk that I was ever on, it was never my fault that I drank. Now, when I look at that, I have a little difficulty with it. Because it would appear that someplace along the line, I would have had one drunk that was my fault just by accident, you know, if nothing else. But up until my last drunk, I always had a perfectly legitimate reason for every drunk I was ever on. It was your fault. If you stupid people that have lived like I knew you should, and like I told you how, I wouldn't have had a drink at you. So it was your fault. It was the boss's fault. It was conditions and circumstances. It was my wife's fault. She didn't love me enough. So She was a pretty good reason for me getting drunk. But as good as she was, she couldn't hold a candle to her mother. Her mother had only one child, and I was married to her. And she was living with us. And she had a grandstand seat watching me crucify her only daughter. And she didn't like me very good. And I didn't like her that good. Because, you see, if she hadn't been living with us, I wouldn't have had to crucify her daughter. It was her fault, the whole damn thing. We had a mutual hating society that was a beautiful thing to behold. She lived with us 5 years after I came to the program. And I would love to be able to tell you, this one audience, what this program of ours did for her. She sure did change. Never had a drunk that was my fault until my last one. I am not going to tell you much about my drinking. Clancy told you all about that this afternoon. Said that guy has a most marvelous way of telling us about our shortcomings. Doesn't he? He takes the blame for all of them himself, you know. He's talking about him. But he sure does do me some harm there. That's a bunch of stuff he puts out. So there's no use for me to talk about that. He's covered it. But I'll tell you a little bit about my last trip to the well and what's happened since. My last go-round with the bottle started a Friday before Christmas, 1945. I went down to the office feeling pretty good because Christmas was right around the corner. And Christmas is New Year's, a good time to do a little drinking. So, it wasn't going to be long. And I was feeling pretty good when I got to the office, but I found a note there from my boss man asked me to come in and see him. Well, I didn't want to go in and see him. I knew what he looked like. And I also knew what he wanted to see me about. He was going to can me. That's what he was going to do. Because I knew I had it coming. And I didn't want to go in, but he said, come in and see me, and I went and see him. And instead of shooting me, as he had every right to do, he started talking, which was a good sign. And he said to me, Charlie, I was Charlie in business. He says, you've had a lot of trouble this year. Now, he never mentioned booze. But he knew that I knew what he meant when he said trouble. And he was a non-alcoholic, so he had it all figured out. So he says, I think I know your problem. I think it's because of the pressure you are under. Now, says he, I'm going to take a little of the pressure off of you. And maybe next year you won't have so much pressure and you won't have so much trouble. And again, instead of shooting me, he gave me $3,000 for a Christmas present. The Friday before Christmas, 1945, to take the pressure off of me. Now, if you don't think he took the pressure off of me, you're nuts. There's one thing worse for an alky than bad fortune, and that's good fortune. So I got drunk on the way home. Now, this is impossible, because I was a periodic. And periodics don't get drunk on the way home. Periodics never taper off. Periodics taper on. We have a regular routine. We drink till we can't get it down, can't get it up, can't live, and can't die. And then we have to quit. And in my day, there wasn't any easy way to quit. They didn't have a detox center in every other block. You know. We just had to die until we could get well. And that's what we did. And so we had a regular routine on that, too. We'd die and die and die, and then we'd start getting a little better so we could drink a bit of milk and take vitamins. Oh, God, vitamins. We ate vitamins with the buckets. And we'd get better, and then we would analyze our last performance. And we'd see where we made our mistakes. And we decided not to do it that way anymore. And we had everything in its place and a place for everything. And then we'd start sampling. And we'd sample our way right on back to bed. But not in a hurry. It usually took me from 30 to 60 days to get off my feet. And near my last trip out, I got drunk on the way home. And I remember nothing from the Friday before Christmas, 1945, until after the middle of January, 1946. Best I can figure, it was 3.5, 4 weeks. In total blackout. I remember nothing. Now, if I could remember taking the first drink, or one of the middle drinks, or the last drink, I think I'm smart enough to figure out a way to take credit for the last 35 years. But I can't remember anything. My wife, if she was talking to you, she would tell you that I destroyed 7 quarts of whiskey every 3 days during that whole time. Now, don't go out of here and say, I said I did that. I did not say that. She says it. And I can't even argue with her because I don't know. I wasn't there. She was. And besides, I don't think 7 quarts is too much for 3 days. If you only do it a few 3 days, like, say, 15 days or something like that. But if you do it, say, 4 weeks, it's either too much or just enough. And in my case, I think it was just enough. Because when I came to, sometime after the middle of January 1946, everything between me and me had burned out. Every excuse was gone, and every I want was gone. Burned out completely. I didn't have anything between me and me. And I saw me as I was. And for the first time in my life, I knew that I'd lost the battle of life. And it was the first time in 43 years that I had ever admitted defeat. And this time, I didn't know why, but I knew that I'd lost the battle of life. And I accepted it. And I knew why my good wife, after 20 years, was divorcing me. And I might say quickly, without cause. Hadn't I given her 20 of the best years of my life? She was divorcing me. And I knew she should have done it 10 years before. I knew why our kids wouldn't come home when I was around. And I knew that everything dear to me in life was gone and should be gone, and that I was not entitled to have it back. Now, I'm going to say that again because that's what my life has been built on for a little over 35 years. I totally and completely accepted the fact that everything dear to me in life is gone and should be gone, and I wasn't entitled to have it back. I also accepted death, because I'd come that close to dying the next to the last trip out, and this was worse. The next to the last trip out, I'd come through the living room in my withdrawal period to go to the kitchen after a glass of buttermilk. Mrs. C. and Richard were sitting in the living room, and they heard me let out a beller and heard me hit the floor. And they came running out thinking they'd find me in an alcoholic convulsion, which was my wont. But I wasn't convulsing. I was just lying there on the kitchen floor as peaceful as anybody you ever saw. I wasn't doing nothing. They tell me I was a peculiar color. I was blue. And they couldn't wake me up, because my wife had, after they had failed to wake me up, had called the Beverly Hills Receiving Hospital and asked if they could send down a squad to see if they could bring me around. And as serious as this is, this thing just tickles the hell out of me, because my wife and my kids had been praying for me to die for at least 5 years. And they come out in the kitchen and find me dead. And what'd they do? They call the oxygen squad. Don't that blow your gourd? Well, I remember what happened after I came to that time. There was a young doctor with these monkeys, and he said to me, to all intents and purposes, you were dead. He says, we had a hell of a time bringing you to, and it's our opinion that nobody will ever bring you to again under these circumstances. And then he gave me the finest piece of counsel I'll ever hear. He looked me right in the eye and he said, if I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. Now I want to pass that on. If I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. But I'd do it again. And the last time was worse than the next to the last time. So I knew I was going to die and didn't care. But I didn't want to die with a record. I never got to the place in my entire drinking career where I didn't love my wife and my kids. They knew I didn't. Mrs. C. told me probably 500 times, Chuck, if you loved us, you wouldn't do these things. Now, how the hell could I tell her it was because I loved them that I did? But it was the truth. You see, I was periodic for that whole last 11 years. And I could look at my wife and my kids with physically dry eyes. And I knew I was crucifying them. And I wanted to take them in my arms and say, look, I love you. I will never do this again, so help me. But I couldn't. I'd already done it. And I knew I was going to do it again, because I didn't know how not to do it again. And all I could do in those times was to lie in bed. My bed was just that far from hers. Might as well have been in Siberia. And I'd lie there until I could tell by her breathing that she was asleep. And then I'd cry that pillow full of tears, because I knew what I was doing to that family, and I didn't know how not to do it, and I knew I was going to do it again. And all I could do there is cry me up a river, you know? So, I knew I was going to die. It was all right. But I didn't want to die with a record. I didn't want Mrs. C. and the kids to remember me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. And fortunately for me, 4.5 years prior to this time, Mrs. C. had found Zach Alexander's article in the Post, Saturday Evening Post. And she had read it. And she thought that it might be of some benefit to me. So she left it open at the right page on the left arm of the chair I sit in right today, hoping that when I came in, if I came in, I'd read it. And evidently I did. But I was drunk when I read it, and I remembered that morning only two things about the article. I remembered that drunks helped drunks and didn't drink, and they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I will find AA. And immediately, my little period of sanity was over. I was sickened to death, drunk, and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from the moment of commitment until right now, I have never had a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind. Such is the great significance of this thing called surrender. Surrender. Surrender is victory for the alcoholic. It's the most amazing thing on the face of the earth. I would rather be able to tell one audience what it means to surrender than to be president of the universe. But it cannot be done. There's no way to explain surrender to anybody. You have to experience it yourself to know what it means. I think the greatest line in our book is we cease to fight anything or anybody, including ourselves. We cease to fight anything or anybody. If we be alcoholic, we win the battle by giving up the fight. We win the war by giving up the fight. It's the most amazing thing in the world. Now, it took me a little while to get well enough to start hunting for Alcoholics Anonymous. My keen alcoholic mind told me you would not be in the phone book. You were anonymous, weren't you? They don't anonymous in the phone book. So knowing you weren't there, I never looked. And that's the story of my life. I know so damn much that it wasn't true, I couldn't learn anything it was. So, I had to call people and ask them if they knew anybody that knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got a hold of a doctor in Beverly Hills that gave me a name and address of one of our members. All of you would know him if I wanted to call his name. He was a motion picture actor. And I called him up. And we talked a little while, and he says, have you had a drink today? And I said, no. But he says, don't take one. I have to work tonight, and I can't take you to meeting. So call me tomorrow. I might not have to be working tomorrow night, and I'll take you to meeting. So call me tomorrow. So I called him tomorrow, and we talked a little while, and he says, you had a drink today? And I said, no. He says, don't take one. I'm still working. Call me tomorrow. So the third day I called him. And we talked a little while, and I knew by the way he was going that he was still working. So I said, you're still working, aren't you? And he says, yes. I said, you don't need to take me to a meeting. Where is a meeting I can go to? I'll go under my own power. And he told me. Well, the meeting wasn't more than 10 minutes from my house. And I determined to go. And I felt all right about it until about 10 minutes before time to start. And then I did the unforgivable thing. I started to think. If you don't get it from my talk, I'll tell you right now. I think that thinking is what got us here. It wasn't drinking. It was thinking. I've had a project on for some time. I figure that sometime before I die, I want to make every group and every club in the United States and Canada pick up every think sign in the whole bunch and have a bonfire. So I start to think. And again, my keen alcoholic mind told me, look, son, you've been living in Beverly Hills for a long time, and it just might not be good for your reputation to be seen with a bunch of drunks. Now, you'll never know how funny that is, because I wore out either two or three chiefs of police in Beverly Hills. My last 10 years out there, I'd spent almost as much time in the jailhouse as a jailer. And here I am concerned about being seen with a bunch of alcoholics who were doing something about their problem. But I talked myself out of it. I said, I can disguise myself a little bit so I won't be immediately recognized. And I'll go anyhow. And I did. And I got there, and it was a large hall, big hall, Veterans of Foreign Wars Hall. And there was a door right in the middle of the back wall, and it was open. And I walked up the door and looked in. And there might have been 35 people in the middle of that room. All of them talking and nobody listening. It's been that way ever since. So I stood in the door and looked at him. And it didn't take me long to discover that they'd given me the wrong information. This was the wrong night. These were the veterans and their wives, and they were there for a party. Because you didn't look like me, and you weren't dressed like me, and you most certainly weren't talking like me, because it was all happy talk, every bit of it. I couldn't understand a word, but it was happy talk. So you couldn't be drunks. And again, my keen alcoholic mind says, you got to go home and come back the night the drunks are here. And I turned to leave. Now, the next minute, in my opinion, is Alcoholics Anonymous. But that, what happened in that next minute, I don't think we'd have any Alcoholics Anonymous at all. Because when I started to leave, somebody in the middle of that room came trotting over to the door and called after me. He says, Mister, were you looking for somebody? And I said, no, sir. But he said, what were you looking for then? And thinking he was a veteran, I said, well, if it would interest you, sir, I was looking for sobriety. And everything about that man changed just like that. It was just like you'd pressed a light switch. He lit up all over it. And it was obvious to me that he was glad it was there. Now, somebody in this room knows what I just said. Here's a man I've never seen before in my life. Total stranger to me. And he was so glad I was there that he lit up all over. And my own flesh and blood wouldn't even spit on me. So I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. And when he did, this is what he said. Why, take off your hat and coat here in the right place. Now, he didn't know it, but that was my disguise. He robbed me in the first minute. And he took me in there and rocked me to sleep. Now, I remember that meeting better than I remember last night's meeting. I remember everything about it. The first thing they told me back in the back room was, if you're an alcoholic, one drink's too many and 1,000 aren't enough. It's the first drink that's killing you. It's the first drink that we must not take. So, that's the very first thing you said. Can't take the first drink. And I played with it a while and bought it, because every time after a dry spell, it was just a question of time from the first slug until I was flat on my back drinking the clock around. So I like that. And I bought it, and I still got it. The second thing they told me was, today is the day we don't drink. God, I wouldn't take $1 million for that. Today is the day we don't drink. Suppose they'd have said to me, you've got to be sober 35 years. I'd have dropped dead. If they'd have said 35 days, I'd have dropped dead. But they didn't. They said, today's the day we don't drink. And they elaborated on that. They said to me, regardless of how long you live in Alcoholics Anonymous, never expand that time more than 24 hours. That's as long as you'll ever live. In AA. And I bought that, and I've still got it. This is my day. I have no past. I want no future. And I thought for a long time that Alcoholics Anonymous members had thought up that 24-hour way of life. I thought that was ours. But I was back in a lot of meetings, and I was listening to you guys close the meetings with the Lord's Prayer. And it suddenly hit me that there was something in there about one day at a time. Somebody a couple of thousand years ago knew a little about that. Because they were saying, give us this day our daily bread. And they didn't say a word about two crusts to wake up on tomorrow morning. And I bought that one, and I still got it. And it's the second greatest lesson I've ever learned. The second greatest lesson I've ever learned is, this is my day. I have no past. I want no future. You know that the past is nothing in the world but guilt, and the future is nothing in the world but fear. And if you're living today, you're skipping both. Really? If I were depending on what I see going on around me, read in the papers, and hear over the news, if I were dependent on that for my peace of mind and serenity purpose, I wouldn't even finish this talk. I'd ready to call an ambulance. I'm going to have a heart attack. Because I don't see anything much happen in this world that looks very good to me, except Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only white spot I see in the world today. Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you get the idea before I get through that I love this thing, you're going to be right. Because I do. This is my day. I have no past. I want no future. And I've ended up now, after 35 years, thinking that now's the only time we'll ever know. Right now. I can see very plainly that the reason it took me so long to get here. When I would come to in those last days, I couldn't dress without a tumbler of whiskey. I couldn't even get up and shave without a tumbler of whiskey. But I wouldn't take it. I'd lie there and look at yesterday. And I would, of course, come up with the conclusion that I had been very foolish. I had drunk too much yesterday. So I had to have a tumbler of whiskey to dress on. But I wouldn't drink any more today than I had to. You know, to get by. I was going to be very, very careful. Wouldn't drink a thing that I didn't have to navigate. And then the next morning I wouldn't have to have a tumbler of whiskey to dress. I'd be all right. But every time I came to, it was now, and I was thirsty. So there I'd go again, you see. So it's quite a thing to be able to live in the now. This is my day. I have no past. I want no future. So I bought that one, and I've still got it. Again, the second greatest lesson I've ever learned. The next thing you told me was, stay close to us. Stay close to us. Get into as many AA meetings as you can, said you. Because there is more wisdom in this room about your problem and its answer than in any other room on the face of the earth, except another room just like this, where AA members are meeting. So get into as many meetings as you can. And how about that? And I've still got it. I've attended nearer 5 than 4 meetings a week for 35 years. And I've never attended one too many. And you might say, how do you know? Because I never had it so good. This is the only easy life I've ever known in my entire lifetime. The only good life that's ever been mine. And I'm not about to change a winning formula. I'll be attending these meetings until you pat me in the face with a scoop. And I'll be loving them. And if I left tonight, I'd be totally and completely overpaid. Because I've had a hell of a life for 35 years. Thanks to you guys and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a God of my very own. Highly recommended. The next thing you told me was, why I can't drink like other people. Clancy went through that awful good this afternoon. If you missed it, you ought to buy a tape. If you got enough after you've bought mine. This is the thing that used to just drive me nuts. I knew, without even thinking twice, that I was a hell of a lot smarter than the people I was drinking with. But they weren't getting in jail. I played a lot of poker in those days. And I was a good poker player. And the last thing I'd remember is that I had all the money on the table. And the next morning when I came to, I'd be getting phone calls. And I owed everybody in Beverly Hills. You know. And I couldn't understand it. And then I would say, well, I passed out. And they took all my money after I passed out. And made me hate the whole bunch of them. They shouldn't have taken advantage of me that way, you know. But I was still smarter. And they were. Couldn't understand. Well, I got into all the trouble. And these dummies that I drank with never got in jail or anything like that. So I think it's good for us to know why we can't drink like other people. Several of you people have told me that you've heard my lady talk recently up in this country. She's been saddled with me now for over 55 years, which is indecent in California, you know that. Be married to one broad for 55 years. It's awful. But we've done that. And she belongs to a sister organization. I think they call it Al-Anon in a Hot Cha Cha. If she had decided the day I got sober that she was going to become an alcoholic and had worked at it steadily for 35 years, she would not be an alcoholic. She couldn't make it to save her neck. Because when she drinks one drink, she gets sleepy. She has two, she goes to sleep at the dinner table. And don't treat me like that. I take two, I don't go to the dinner table. So there's a difference. And you told me the first night what that difference was. You told me about the disease of alcoholism. Disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. An allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. The allergy of the body meaning simply this, that for some reason unknown to anybody, My body cannot successfully unlock her. I can't oxidize it, burn it up, and get rid of it. I take one slug of liquor, and it goes into the bloodstream of the brain, and it triggers a demand that I keep on drinking until my cycle is run. And I know it. I got here knowing that. I didn't know why, but you people told me. For some reason unknown to anybody, my body cannot successfully handle alcohol, and for some reason unknown to me until I found you, I can't successfully of myself keep from drinking alcohol. So, you told me the first night that all we could do with the physical part of the disease was to recognize it, see it for what it is, and to know that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, so far as the physical part of the disease is concerned. And there's nothing we can do about it. But that our program is totally set up to relieve us of the obsessions of the mind that make us take the first drink. That's what the program is all about. To make it unnecessary for us to take the first drink. And if we don't take the first drink, we're not going to get drunk. You see? And I played with that and bought it, and I've still got it. It's a terrific thing. Now, I haven't had a drink or a sedating tranquilizing pill for over 35 years, which is not the big deal as far as I'm concerned. The big deal is that I have not had one conscious desire for a drink or a sedating or tranquilizing pill in this entire time. And so I can say to you tonight, without fear of successful contradiction, that the greatest single event that ever happened in my life is when the bottle killed me in January 1946. When I went through the gates of insanity and death in January 1946. And everything between me and me burned out. Including, as I said a minute ago, the I wants. Now, I had only one piece of unfinished business the morning that I came to, and that was to find out some way to not drink now so I could use the time rubbing out the record. I knew I was going to die, and it was all right. Perfectly all right. But I wanted to rub out as much of the record as could before I died. And I found you people, and came to you to find out how not to drink today. So I could use the time rubbing out the record. And I would say to you right now, without, again, fear of successful contradiction, that rubbing out a record and the Alcoholics Anonymous program are equal, identical, and interchangeable. Because if you're going to rub out a record, you got to do something for somebody without a price tag on it. You can't rub out a record thinking I want or don't want or like or don't like. You got to do things for people that they need to have done because you want to. With no price tag whatsoever. And I started doing that 35 years ago. I went to the office before I found you guys, because I knew where the office was, and I didn't know where to find you. So, I went down there, knowing that the boss was going to throw me through the window, because, you see, he had missed me. He gave me $3,000 for a Christmas present to take the pressure off of me the Friday before Christmas. And I show up in late January. And he'd noticed it. And he'd send word to the house that if I ever step foot in a plant again, he's going to throw me through the window. And I went down there knowing he was and knowing that he could. Because I wasn't well. I wasn't well. And he saw my old car in the parking lot, and he knew I was on the premises, and he knew I wasn't going to stay. So he busted in the office like a bull in a china closet. And I couldn't have defended myself with a shotgun. Because I didn't have the shakes. I had the leaps. You know. I was a mess. And all I could do was sit there and say to Victor, "Victor, leave me alone. I don't work for you anymore. I'm down here to clean up this desk. I'm here to do the things you paid me for last year that I didn't do. And as soon as I get even with you, I'll get out of here on my own power. And you'll never owe me a penny as long as you live. But for God's sake, leave me alone. I have to get even with you." And he stopped in his tracks. And he said, "What the hell's happened to you, Charlie?" And I said, "Don't know." And I didn't. Now, I'd had one serious talk before that. When I got well enough, I called my wife in, and she was divorcing me. She was in the legal process of getting rid of me legally. And I called her in. And I said, "Honey, it's no longer of any consequence to me whether or not I live under this roof. It is of absolutely no importance to me at all. I'll never ask a thing of you as long as we live, but one. If I ever have anything that'll add to your life, let me give it to you." And we closed the book. And it's never been reopened. I called the boys in and I said, "Boys, there's no father in the household any longer. You don't need to love me, you don't need to respect me, and you don't need to obey me. I'll never ask a thing of you as long as we live but one. If I ever have anything, be it money, counsel, or blood, that'll add to your life, let me give it to you." And we closed the book. And it's never been reopened. And so, the boss never threw me through the window. He never threw me through the window. And I sat down at the same desk that I'd been sitting at for years, that I had hated for years. Same desk. Doing the same job that I'd hated, because it was beneath my dignity. Anybody with my brains and good looks should at least be a senator, if not president of the United States. And so, I hated the job. Sat down doing the same job for the same boss that I had hated. And there was only one difference. My motivation. Bless you. I was just trying to get even. Only change that was made was my motivation. Rubbing out a record. And to make a long story short, when I was 11 years sober, I bought that business. And when I sold it, I was a wealthy man. And all I was doing was trying to rub out a record. This is the series of things that happened when I first came to the program. I told you about the first meeting. I was back just about every night into a meeting. That one, as often as it met. And I knew that I couldn't have what you people had because I didn't have enough left to get it. But I kept coming back because it was comfortable there. That was one of the reasons. I had two reasons. The second was I didn't have any place else to go. And that helps a great deal. So I was back in a meeting just about every night. And 6 months went by. And I discovered that I hadn't had a drink or a pill for 6 months. That was a discovery. And it was a good discovery. And I was so tickled about it, I got real busy trying to give this thing away. And another 6 months went by. And I discovered that I had a family. And they were living like kittens. And that wasn't a bad discovery. And another year went by. And I discovered I was still down the office trying to clean up my desk. And business was good. And another year went by. And I discovered that my state of being was better than anything I'd ever known. It was just good to be alive. And that ain't a bad discovery. And now 6 years have gone by. And I discovered I was never alone anymore. And this is the great discovery. When we make this discovery, the search is over. And life begins. I discovered I had a God of my very own, and wherever I am, He is. It's a fantastic discovery. Now, had you asked me the first 6 years why I did what I did, I would have told you to rub out a record. And if you'd asked me after 6 years, I would tell you I do it to help God's kids do things they need to have done. Because I want to. Now, I'll tell you how that came about. When I discovered, after walking alone for 43 years prior to my first AA meeting, and then thinking I was alone for the first 6 years after that, that made me 49 years old, that I had walked alone, consciously. From this vantage point, I know that the big thing happened when I was surrendered during my last outing. But I didn't know that until years went by. But I knew that I was never alone anymore. And I said to myself, how am I going to show my gratitude? And the first thing that occurred to me was I was going to make him a plaque. This was a plaque for God. Because we were in the woodworking business and we had some of the finest mechanics in the country. And we could make him an awful pretty plaque. And I had it half designed in my mind when it occurred to me, who in the hell are you going to give it to? And I could see me with this plaque handing it to God and nobody would take it, and I'd drop it on my foot and break my foot. And I thought, well, this is quite a thing. I got a laugh out of that. And then I said, well, how am I going to show my gratitude? And the next decision, I was going to become a Trappist monk. Now, this is not very easy when you're not even Catholic. But I know a good deal about the Trappist monks, and I thought that'd be a good thing to do. Pray for your poor devils, milk a couple of cows, and read a book, and then directly write one. Going to be a Trappist monk, and then I got that pretty well settled. When it occurred to me, wait a minute, big boy. If you have any value to the human race, it's the alcoholic who still suffers. Because you know both his problem and his answer. And you're not going to meet a lot of drunks in a Trappist monk colony. So I had to give that up. And now what are you going to do? To show your gratitude. And this time, this came up. And it was, I've still got this. I remembered that when the carpenter was about to leave, he called in old Pete. Now, you probably would call him St. Peter. I call him old Pete because we were boys together. And he was sort of had an alcoholic personality. When he got caught with the goods, you know, he lied out of it. And that reminds me of me. So, the carpenter called old Pete in and he says, Peter, do you love me? And Pete says, yea, Lord. He says, tend my sheep. And he turned right around and asked him again, Peter, do you love me? He says, yea, Lord. Tend my sheep. And the third time, Peter, did love me. Yea, Lord, tend my sheep. I said, he must have meant tend my sheep. He said it three times. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tend these sheep. And so, for the last 29 years, I've been tending these sheep, helping God's kids do things they need to have done because they want to. Now, I already told you that since I quit going any place, I've been all over the world. Since I quit trying to get anything for myself, I got rich. And so, I have to come to a few conclusions. I have to. And the next few minutes, I'm not going to take much more of your time because you're not going to let me. Because I'm going to tell you the only thing wrong with you. Before I sit down, 10 minutes from now, or 10, 15, 20, half an hour or an hour or so, I'm going to tell you what's wrong with you. I don't believe there's anybody in this room that needs anything added to your life. Nobody in this room. And I can see some of you that think that you've got a lot lacking in your life. Nobody needs anything added to your life. Because I'm totally convinced that everything you've ever wanted to know, you've always known. Everything you've ever wanted to be, you've always been. And everything you've always wanted to have has always been yours. But we don't know it. We don't know it. The gift of God was made at the foundations of the earth. He gave us himself and the universe in the very beginning. And it's always been ours, and he's always known it. But you and I have to discover it for ourselves. And it's a matter of uncovering, discovering, and discarding. Now, this is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Uncover, discover, and discard. We got to uncover the thing we've been looking for all our lives. And we find it. And then we've got to get rid of the misinformation that has been laid on us from the time we were born. Everything that I was taught in home, church, and school, but the multiplication tables, have had to change since I came to you people. Everything. I was born in a family that was too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash. We didn't have from nothing. And of course, we had to get it. We had to get out there in the salt mine and outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver in order to eke out a miserable living out of an unfriendly universe. The early bird gets the worm. Devil takes the hindermost. You got to be there firstest with the mostest. That's what I got, and that's what I lived by for the first 43 years of my life. I never was a fast buck artist. I never was a confidence man. I worked hard to get. And ended up without two coppers to rub together. I was taught that we were born sinners. Half of my family was Methodist Church South, and the other half was Hardshell Baptist. Than which there's nothing whicher. And so they told us we were born sinners. We didn't have to sin to go to hell. We had to get saved to keep from going to hell. So, they talked a good deal about the original sin, but they never told us what it was. And us kids thought they ought to tell us if that was such a big deal, you know. So we figured out what it was ourselves. And it wasn't probably too far from right. We figured that the original sin was had something to do with maybe Adam rearranging Eve's leaves. Otherwise, why didn't he tell us? You know? But anyway, they got me scared bad enough that I tried to get saved at 13. And we had a revival meeting, and I answered the altar call and went down and prayed like hell. And nothing happened. The preacher joined me, and we both prayed like hell. And every once in a while, he'd say, "How you doing?" And I'd say, "No good." And we'd start over it, you know. And we kept praying, and finally he got tired out. And he said to me, "Well, when you're baptized, it'll happen." And when the ice went out, I went in, and he ducked me. And he brought me up, and he said, "How you doing?" I said, "No good. I'm all wet." But that's all. Well, he says, "When you're formally taken into church, it'll happen." And I was, and it didn't. And for the next 30 straight years, I went through every great religion and every great philosophy that the world knows anything about, trying to find out how come I got gypped. And I never found out. And thank God, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not trying to find out. Not trying to find out. Not trying to find God. I'd had it. I came here to find out a way to not drink today, so I could rub out as much of the record as I could before I died. Now, I'm convinced that we can't find God when we're looking for Him. I'm convinced that what we're looking for, we're looking with. What we're looking for, we're looking with. And you can't find Him yonder. You got to find Him where He is, here. And I'll tell you a little story. A four-legged deer told me that. Now, you think that's funny, don't you? But it's truth. I am sort of an Indian. And I love the outdoors. Everything about it I love. And I particularly love animals. And I particularly love the animals, I love deer. And when we moved down to Laguna Beach, I was going through the canyon a great deal late. And I've seen as high as 8 or 10 deer on the road. Because in those days, there was just a 2-lane road through there. And there were lots of deer in the canyon. And I loved them and got a great kick out of them. And, of course, I was always looking for deer when I'd go through the canyon. And I'd invariably look for them where I saw them last. And they wouldn't be there. So I would look then until we got out of the cover. And I would be in the daytime. I would know that no self-respecting deer would be out there in the middle of the field, where he couldn't dodge behind something and get away, you know. So I quit looking. And on this particular day, I was a little late getting off. I'd been out late the night before at a meeting or with a drunk or something. And so I was late getting away, and I was going through the canyon again looking for deer. And I got through the cover, and there wasn't anybody around, and I didn't look anymore until I was up the line a ways. And I just glanced out to my left. That was the prettiest big buck you ever saw. There wasn't a blade of grass for him to hide behind. And he said to me, "You see them where they are." You see them where they are. You don't see them where you think they ought to be or where you saw them last. You see them where they are. And before I got to town, I'd taken that through every relationship in life. Every relationship in life. And I'd like to have time to go through that too, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to tell you one thing. One of the things that the alcoholic mind, male alcoholic mind, has always sort of had in his back of his head, there would be paradise on earth. To look across the breakfast table every morning at a new woman. Now that would be heaven, wouldn't it, huh? For a drunk? And I started looking at that first, and you know something? That's what I've been doing for 50 years. Looking across the table at a new woman every morning. Because my wife isn't the lady that she was yesterday morning. She's the lady she was yesterday morning plus yesterday's experience and its lesson. So she's brand new every morning. We've had a picnic out of that since then. No more strife. I don't even want to make her over. She's all right with me. Okay, what are we talking about? We're talking about uncovering, discovering, and discarding. The gift of God was made at the foundations of the earth. The universe is mine, and all that God has is mine. It always was, and He's always known it. He's never been confused. But I have to discover it for myself, and it's uncover, discover, and discard. Now, how do I know? It's not because St. Francis said it. You know, St. Francis said, it's better to love than to be loved. It's better to understand than to be understood. For it is in giving that we receive, forgiving that we're forgiven, and in dying to self, or surrender, that we awaken to eternal life. Now, you Catholics in the audience know I changed that last line. I changed everything that I don't like. I changed St. Francis' prayer because I said to myself, what do you mean by that? He certainly didn't mean that we had to wait till we died to find out that life is eternal. And so I'm going to use it like it ought to be. It's surrender. Uncover and discover. Surrender. And then I thought, well, wait a minute now. You can't go out and tell these Catholics that. You know? Without a little authority. So I knew the gang out in Manresa are pretty good. A bunch of jebbies out there. And I called them up. Got old Father Toner on the line. I said, Father, look what I did to St. Francis' prayer. For it is in dying to self or surrender that we awaken to eternal life. You know what that monkey said to me?
What the hell do you think he meant?
Just like he'd known it all his life. What the hell do you think he meant, he says. He never even thought of it till I told him. So I can use that now because I got a little authority. See, I figured that if you took all the Catholics and all the Southerners out of this society of ours, you could hold an international convention in a phone booth. Which is pretty near the case, isn't it? Anyhow, I also changed a line in the Lord's Prayer. From the time I was a little old kid, I didn't believe that God could lead me into temptation. He wouldn't be God if he was leading me into temptation. So I changed it. Thou leadest us not into temptation, but delivereth us from evil. And I've always said it the way other people say it, but I thought it in my head. Thou leadest us not into temptation, but delivereth us from evil. And after I got big enough, I bought a direct translation from Aramaic, which was the tongue of Jesus. And it says right in there, thou leadest us not into temptation, but delivereth us from evil. I thought that's pretty good. So I changed the 11th step. Too many words in 11th step, so I changed it. My 11th step reads like this. I get up in the morning and I say, look, Dad, I'm reporting for duty. Now I'm going to move it around. I'm going to do the best I can with what I got today. And all I want out of you is a little guidance and direction, power to carry it out. Sure, thank you. And I go about my business in total expectancy of guidance and direction. And I get it. And you might say, how do you know that? And I gotta tell you, I never had it so good. It's the only good life I've ever known, the only easy life that's ever been mine. So I'm not about to change. Now, lastly, I don't believe any of this stuff because somebody else said it. Don't believe any of it because somebody else said it. I believe it because it happened to me. It happened to me. In my life, it happened. And that's the reason I believe it. And I've come to believe now that the only roadblock between me and you and me and God is the human ego. I want it, don't want it, like it, don't like it, I think that's the only problem in life. When that's gone, there are no problems. Because, you see, that's the way it happened to me. I came to in January 1946 without any I wants. Now the world, this so-called civilization of ours, knows that it's not normal not to want something for yourself. Not to be going someplace. You know, I've had nothing to prove. I've not been going any place. Nothing to win. And nothing to get for 35 years. And everything that I ever dreamed of and ended up without. I was a failure as a husband, father, businessman, man, and drunk. At the ripe old age of 43. Every department of life, a total failure. And now everything that I ever dreamed of, that I would like in life, has come into my life without any effort on my part to get it. So I'm totally convinced that the more we pour out without a price tag on it, the more we have. Because it's happened in my own life. And of course, again and again and again. That's what this program of ours is. It's rubbing out a record. And it's helping each other rub out a record. It's going about God's business. Helping his kids do things they need to have done because they want to. And in the very doing of it, we find that these little cliches mean what they say. Fear not, little flock. It's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. Take no thought of the morrow. What shall eat, what shall drink, or wherewithal you shall be clothed. Your heavenly Father knoweth what you have need of before you ask him. Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. What is he talking about? He's talking about God being sufficient unto all of our needs. Now I'm totally convinced right now that the only way anybody will ever know that the Alcoholics Anonymous program works is to work it. I doubt if there's anybody in this room that ever saw me drunk. You don't know whether I'm drunk or not. I might be a good liar. I might have joined this leper colony because I'm queer for donuts and coffee. You don't know. So you can't take my word for it. I still lie a lot. The only way you'll know ever that this program works is to work it. And the only way that you will ever know that God is sufficient unto all of your needs is to act like it and prove it. And the little verse that covers that is, act as though I am and I will be, saith the Lord. It's a fascinating thing. It is absolutely, totally consuming. It's the greatest thing that could possibly happen to anybody is to discover that we are our Father's children. God, my Father, I his child.